According to the principal, she declares shyly, and then points out the home's numerous special features. The exterior is going to be rammed earth, or maybe adobe, she explains. It's 85 feet long by 77 feet wide, all on one floor. This center part here will be open, like a courtyard. Over on this side is where the children's rooms are, one for the girls, one for the boys. Plus, there's a nursery for the young ones. The father's room, the master bedroom's over here. And these are the mother's rooms, one wife here and the other wife there. And the neat thing is there's space to add another room here for a third wife. As she describes the many unique elements she has designed, her enthusiasm builds. By the end of the virtual tour, her eyes are gleaming. This is her dream home, customized for what she imagines to be the perfect life, the life she hopes to live when she grows up. Chapter 26, Canaan Mountain. In the plateau country, the eye is not merely invited but compelled to notice the large things. From any point of vantage, the view is likely to be open not with the 12 or 15-mile radius of the plains, but with a radius that is often 50 and sometimes even 75 miles, and that is a long way to look, especially if there is nothing human in sight. The villages are hidden in the canyons and under the cliffs. There is nothing visible but the torn and slashed and wind-worn beauty of the absolute wasteland. And the beauty is death. Where the grass and trees and bushes are stripped off and the world laid naked, you can see the globe being torn down and rebuilt. You can see the death and prognosticate the birth of epochs. You can see the tiny clinging bits of debris that historical time has left. If you were a Mormon waiting for the trump of the last days while you labor in building the kingdom, you can be excused for expecting that those last days will come any time now. The world is dead and disintegrating before your eyes. Wallace Stegner, Mormon Country. From a tranquil city park at the edge of Colorado City, Hilldale, the sheer cliffs of Canaan Mountain erupt heavenward without preamble. A massive scarp of brick-red sandstone streaked with desert varnish, looming 2,000 vertical feet above the fundamentalist stronghold. On top, the flat summit plateau feels like a lost world, an island in the sky cut off from civilization, sprouting manzanita and mariposa lilies, wild roses and yucca, Indian paintbrush and stout ponderosa pines. My brother David and I used to sneak up here every chance we got when we were kids, says Deloy Bateman. Seemed like the only place where the religion couldn't control us. Deloy's perched at the edge of this mountaintop, staring down at the town where he was born and raised. It's the end of July and the temperature is 104 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. Deloy, who seems oblivious to the withering heat even though he is wearing long polyester pants, a long-sleeved shirt, and the religion's trademark long underwear, is an apostate from the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and has no respect for its new prophet Warren Jeffs. But he still resides in this xenophobic community, smack in the middle of town, and doubts that he'll ever live very far away. Deloy no longer practices plural marriage. The second of his two wives moved out and now lives in St. George. Her kids have remained with Deloy in Colorado City, and she comes to visit them every week. Since I don't believe in what the religion teaches anymore, he explains, I just can't justify polygamy. And it isn't merely the fundamentalist religion that Deloy has abandoned. He announces that he's done with religion, period. Unlike most who have rejected the teachings of the FLDS Church, he didn't convert to mainline Mormonism, or another branch of Christianity, or some New Age faith. Deloy has become an atheist. He no longer believes in God. It hasn't been an easy transformation. My whole life I've had this need to believe in something, he says. I've wanted answers to why we were put here, just like everybody else. The religion provided those answers, and there's so much else that's good about it. The truth is, everything I ever learned came from this religion. It made me what I am, and I'm proud of what I am. This religion is in my blood. I mean, heck, look at me. Holding his arms out from his sides, palms forward, Deloy looks down at what he's wearing and takes stock with a self-deprecating snort. Even though I don't believe anymore, I'm still wearing the garment. The sacred long underwear. I try not to wear it, but I just can't seem to leave it off, even on hot summer days like this. For some reason, not wearing it just doesn't feel right. I feel naked. He laughs again, then adds, that ought to tell you something about the power of this religion. Deloy returns his gaze to the orderly grid of homes and fields at the base of the mountain. It's hard for outsiders to accept, but there is so much that's positive about this town. The people that live in those houses down there, they're extremely hardworking and strong. Yeah, I'm real attached to Colorado City. I think it's a real good community to raise a family in. Deloy says this and means it, even though he's talked at length to several of the women in town who've reported being sexually abused as girls and insist that pedophilia is rampant within the community. I don't doubt their stories are true, he acknowledges. I know for a fact there's men in the priesthood who have slept with their own daughters, which is horrible. But that kind of thing goes on everywhere, and I actually think there's less of it here than in the outside world. In any case, it wasn't the culture's sexual customs or its lifestyle constraints that finally induced Deloy to apostatize. Rather, he says, it just got to be where I could no longer ignore that the religion is a lie. It's not like the prophets that control everybody are intentionally fooling the people. As far as I can tell, Rulon and Warren and Winston and them sincerely believe the lie themselves. I'm not sure about that, but I think so. And it's not just their religion that's a lie. I've really come to believe that all religions are lies. Every single one of them. Could there be supreme power out there somewhere? Is there a grand plan behind the Big Bang, the creation of the universe, the evolution of species? I don't know. I suppose it's possible. I guess I'd like to at least allow for the possibility in the back of my mind. But common sense tells me otherwise. Although Deloy says that he was extremely religious throughout his youth, he also had a probing, unremittingly curious mind. Even as a young boy, he says, I remember wondering about contradictions between what the religion taught and scientific truth. But Uncle Roy told us that the way to handle that was just to avoid asking certain kinds of questions. So I trained myself to ignore the contradictions. I got good at not letting myself think about them. Because Deloy was smart and the religion needed educators for its school, when he turned 18, the prophet, his adoptive grandfather, Uncle Roy, sent him to Southern Utah State College, an hour up the road in Cedar City, to become a teacher. I was sent with him, recalls Deloy's first wife, Eunice Bateman, who had been commanded by the prophet to marry Deloy a short while earlier. Neither of us had ever lived outside of Colorado City. Our second child was born a year after he started school. I felt so different from everyone there. I felt like an outcast. I was homesick for Colorado City the whole time Dee was in college, but I kept pretty busy raising babies and doing his typing and helping with his homework. After getting his degree, Deloy returned to Colorado City and went to work educating the town's youth. Despite feeling like a fish out of water when he left his hometown and set up residence in the larger world, Deloy says, I loved college. Looking back, I suppose it was the beginning of the end for me. I stayed in the religion for another 20 years, but going to college in Cedar City was when I had my eyes opened. That's where I took my first geology course. Afterward, I came home and told Uncle Roy, there's a professor over there trying to tell us the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, but the religion says it's only 6,000 years old. How can that be? Which shows you why education is such a problem for the work. You take someone like me, who was always as stalwart as could be, and then you ship him off to get an education, and the guy goes and apostatizes on you. Happens over and over again. And every time it does, it makes the leaders more inclined to keep people from learning. When Deloy finally lost his faith and left the UEP, his three oldest kids were married and no longer living at home. These three children have remained in the religion, but he has worked hard to teach the other 14 kids to think for themselves and to question what the UEP has inculcated. Sometimes I worry about what would become of the little ones, Deloy muses, if something happened to me and the wife. If we died. My older children would take the younger kids into their homes and look after them, but they'd be brought right back into the religion. I think those kids would be happy with that. They'd probably never know the difference. But they'd be stunted. They'd never get to exercise their imaginations. To help prepare his children for this possibility and to instill in them a healthy skepticism about religious dogma of all kinds, on December 31, 1999, Deloy and Eunice loaded their entire brood into two vans. Whenever the Bateman family travels anywhere together, at least two large vehicles are required to transport everyone, and made the 3-hour drive to Las Vegas in order to ring in the new millennium. We took them all down to the center of the Las Vegas Strip, he explains, which is supposedly one of the wickedest places on Earth and the first place God was going to destroy when the clock struck midnight. We went to the New York casino and stood outside in the street there with thousands and thousands of other people as the ball dropped, and they counted down the seconds to the year 2000. And you know what? The millennium came and the world didn't end. I think that made quite an impression on the kids. Deloy laughs hard, shaking his head. Now that he's no longer a member of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Deloy is astonished at some of the beliefs the religion instills in its members. It staggers me, he says, to look back on the things I used to believe. For example, ever since I was a child, we were taught that Negroes were terrible, that they weren't even human, and we had no way to learn otherwise. There were never any blacks in town. They were entirely foreign to us. I never even seen a Negro until I was practically an adult when I saw one on a trip down to St. George. I remember staring at him for just as long as I could stare. I'd never encountered such a creature. It was like he was some kind of strange animal to me. That's an awful thing to believe, I know. I feel guilty about it now. But it's the way I was brought up from day one. And when you're brought up to believe something like that, it's not easy to overcome it. Just the other night, when I went to bed, I turned on the TV for a minute, and Oprah happened to be on. And I found myself immediately changing the channel, just because she was black. I knew even as I was doing it that it was wrong, but that's what the religion taught me to think, and it's surprisingly hard to shake something that's so deeply ingrained. What's really sad is children in the religion are still being taught those same exact things today. Indeed, the FLDS Church continues to teach that interracial marriage is a sin so great that the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot. A horror of miscegenation is something Mormon fundamentalists have in common with their Mormon brethren. Even after LDS President Spencer W. Kimball's 1978 revelation reversing the church doctrine that banned blacks from the priesthood, official LDS policy has continued to strongly admonish white saints not to marry blacks. Make no mistake, the modern Mormon church may now be in the American mainstream, but it usually hugs the extreme right edge of the flow. It's amazing how gullible people are, Deloy continues, but you have to remember what a huge comfort the religion is. It provides all the answers. It makes life simple. Nothing makes you feel better than doing what the prophet commands you to do. If you have some controversial issue that you're dealing with, let's say you owe a lot of money to somebody and you don't have the means to pay them, you go in and talk to the prophet and he might tell you, you don't have to pay the money back. The Lord says it's okay. And if you just do what the prophet says, all the responsibility for your actions is now totally in his hands. You can refuse to pay the guy or even kill somebody or whatever and feel completely good about it. And that's a real big part of what holds this religion together. It's not having to make those critical decisions that many of us have to make and be responsible for your decisions. Deloy looks out across the epic sweep of desert. In the distance on the far side of the Arizona Strip, the dreamy silhouettes of Mount Dellenbaugh and Mount Trumbull hover in midair, suspended above a quivering sheen of mirage. If you want to know the truth, he says, squinting into the glare, I think people within the religion, people who live here in Colorado City, are probably happier on the whole than people on the outside. He looks down at the red sand, scowls, and nudges a rock with the toe of one shoe. But some things in life are more important than being happy, like being free to think for yourself. Author's remarks. There were no formerly heroic times, and there was no formerly pure generation. There is no one here but us chickens, and so it has always been. A people busy and powerful, knowledgeable, ambivalent, important, fearful, and self-aware. A people who scheme, promote, deceive, and conquer. Who pray for their loved ones and long to flee misery and skip death. It is a weakening and discoloring idea that rustic people knew God personally once upon a time, or even knew selflessness or courage or literature, but that it is too late for us. In fact, the absolute is available to everyone in every age. There never was a more holy age than ours, and never a less. Annie Dillard, for the time being. The genesis for this book was a desire to grasp the nature of religious belief. Because I've spent most of my life in the West in the happy company of Latter-day Saints, I decided to narrow my subject to a more manageable scope by examining belief more or less exclusively through the lens of Mormonism. I grew up with Mormons in Corvallis, Oregon, which had and has a robust LDS community. Saints were my childhood friends and playmates, my teachers, my athletic coaches. I envied what seemed to be the unfluctuating certainty of the faith professed so enthusiastically by my closest Mormon pals. But I was often baffled by it. I've sought to comprehend the formidable power of such belief ever since. I was irresistibly drawn to write about Latter-day Saints not only because I already knew something about their theology and admired much about their culture, but also because of the utterly unique circumstances in which their religion was born. The Mormon Church was founded a mere 173 years ago, in a literate society, in the age of the printing press. As a consequence, the creation of what became a worldwide faith was abundantly documented in first-hand accounts. Thanks to the Mormons, we have been given an unprecedented opportunity to appreciate, in astonishing detail, how an important religion came to be. I must confess that the book you are now reading isn't the book I set out to write. As originally conceived, it was going to focus on the uneasy, highly charged relationship between the LDS Church and its past. I'd even come up with the title, History and Belief. I intended to explore the inner trials of spiritual thinkers who walk in the shadows of faith, as Pierre Teilhard de Chardin described it. How does a critical mind reconcile scientific and historical truth with religious doctrine? How does one sustain belief when confronted with facts that appear to refute it? I was fascinated by the paradoxes that reside at the intersection of doubt and faith, and I had a high regard for congenital skeptics like Teilhard, who somehow emerged from the fray with their belief intact. The research, however, kept pulling me onto a slightly different heading, and after fighting it for many months, I decided to surrender to this unplanned course and see where it might take me. The upshot, for better or worse, is that I wrote Under the Banner of Heaven instead of History and Belief. Who knows? Maybe someday I will yet complete the latter. I spent approximately a year writing this book and more than 3 years doing the research on which the writing is based. I traveled many thousands of miles to visit the saints' most sacred sites and to interview dozens of individual Mormons, fundamentalist Mormons, and apostate Mormons face to face. I interviewed others over the telephone. Some of these people asked me to protect their privacy, and I have done so by giving them pseudonyms in these pages. In the case of Dan Lafferty, I visited him in November 2001 at Point of the Mountain in the maximum security unit of the Utah State Prison. After my initial interview, which lasted the better part of an afternoon, he answered countless follow-up questions with unsettling candor by writing me many long, detailed letters. Additionally, I reviewed thousands of pages of transcripts from the three trials and numerous hearings that ultimately determined the guilt of Dan and his brother Ron. In an essay titled The Empire of Clean, Timothy Egan, a reporter for the New York Times, observed, "In the beehive state of Utah, nearly every town, church, and family of any standing keeps a record, a daily diary of the Mormon dream. Typically, it is a ledger of life on two levels. One long on struggle and triumph, the story of the creation of Zion in the American West. The other, more spiritual but no less detailed. They know in Orderville exactly who was hungry in 1912 and who committed adultery in 1956, but they also know whether somebody's ancestor from the 15th century has been given a valid passport to eternal life. Every wagon train drama, Every horrific entry from the epic, killing mistake of the handcart migration, every basketball championship over the Indian kids in Carbon County is written down somewhere. No state has more keepers of history or better archives honeycombed in climate-controlled vaults than Utah. Mormons have made a workaday craftsmanship of keeping the past alive. There is a record, the saints like to say, of everything. I availed myself of this rich history by draining my bank account in bookstores near and far. I also made several visits to the archives of the Utah State Historical Society in Salt Lake City and the Harold B. Lee Library at Brigham Young University in Provo. During my reading, I was struck by the impact three writers in particular have made on the interpretation of Mormon history. Fawn Brody, the author of No Man Knows My History, Juanita Brooks, the author of The Mountain Meadows Massacre, and D. Michael Quinn, the author of Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, and The Mormon Hierarchy, Extensions of Power. Each of these historians was born into the Mormon Church, and their faith, or loss thereof in Brody's case, informed and enhanced their scholarship, which is distinguished by its courageous, unflinching honesty. Brody died in 1981 and Brooks in 1989, but Quinn, currently 58 years old, is still a productive scholar at the height of his intellectual powers. Quinn's writing lacks the eloquence of Brody's and the unembellished narrative force of Brooks's, and as a consequence, his books have not been widely read by the general public. The influence of his prodigious work, however, has been huge among Mormon historians, and no writer since Fawn Brody has provoked such intense condemnation from the LDS general authorities. Quinn studied as an undergraduate at BYU, went on to receive a doctorate from Yale, and then returned to BYU as an inspired professor of history. He first aroused the ire of LDS leaders in 1981 when he presented a now-famous lecture to the BYU Student History Association. Titled On Being a Mormon Historian, it was a response to a recent attack on those academics like Quinn who dared to publish work that was critical of the church's official, extensively expurgated version of Mormon history. The tragic reality, he declared in his lecture, is that there have been occasions when church leaders, teachers, and writers have not told the truth they knew about difficulties of the Mormon past, but have offered to the saints instead a mixture of platitudes, half-truths, omissions, and plausible denials. Quinn argued a so-called faith-promoting church history, which conceals controversies and difficulties of the Mormon past, actually undermines the faith of Latter-day Saints who eventually learn about the problems from other sources. One of the most painful demonstrations of that fact has been the continued spread of unauthorized polygamy among the Latter-day Saints during the last 75 years, despite the concerted efforts of church leaders to stop it. Quinn pointed out that after officially renouncing the doctrine of plural marriage in 1890, the highest leaders, in fact, continued to sanction polygamy, covertly for many years. And this casuistry, he insisted, has driven many Mormons into the embrace of fundamentalism. The central argument of the enemies of the LDS Church, Quinn said, is historical. And if we seek to build the kingdom of God by ignoring or denying the problem areas of our past, we are leaving the saints unprotected. As one who has received death threats from anti-Mormons because they perceive me as an enemy historian, it is discouraging to be regarded as subversive by men I sustain as prophets, seers, and revelators. The text of Quinn's lecture, which resonated strongly among Mormon intellectuals, was printed on the front page of an underground student newspaper, infuriating the LDS general authorities in Salt Lake City and sparking a raging controversy that made the pages of Newsweek magazine. It was the beginning of Quinn's fall from grace in the church he loved. By 1988, he was pressured into resigning his tenured professorship at BYU. And in 1993, following a highly publicized hearing by an LDS disciplinary council, he became one of six prominent Mormon scholars who were excommunicated from the LDS Church for apostasy. The church wanted to send a very public message to dissidents, Quinn says. Their goal was intimidation, to silence dissent. Banishment from the church came as a harsh blow. Even if you have all kinds of objections to church policies, he explains, when you're a believing Mormon, to be excommunicated is like a form of death. It's like attending your own funeral. You feel the loss of that sense of community. I miss it deeply. Quinn's standing in the LDS church was not helped by the fact that in the mid-1980s he revealed that he is gay. The Mormon general authorities continue to make the church a very difficult place for homosexuals. Despite Mormonism's entrenched homophobia and Quinn's unsparing, clear-eyed assessment of Mormonism's faults, his faith in the religion of Joseph Smith remains undiminished. "I'm a radical believer," he says, "but I'm still a believer." He seems to be one of those rare spiritual thinkers, as Annie Dillard puts it, who possess a sort of anaerobic capacity to batten and thrive on paradox. At a very early age, Quinn acknowledges, I developed what I call a complex testimony. Instead of a black-white view of Mormonism, I have an Old Testament sort of faith. The writers of the Old Testament presented the prophets as very human vessels, warts and all. Yet God still chose them to be his leaders on earth. That's how I see Mormonism. It is not a perfect church. It has huge flaws in both the institution and the people who lead it. They are only human, and I have no trouble accepting that. It's all part of my faith. On the very first page of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith wrote that if it contained mistakes or faults, it be the mistakes of men. And this same thing is stated in various ways throughout the text that follows, that errors in this sacred book are possible, even likely. I have always believed that Mormonism was the one true church, but I don't think it has ever been infallible. And I certainly don't believe it has a monopoly on the truth. One of the events that led to Dr. Quinn's excommunication was the publication in 1987 of Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, a fascinating, exhaustively researched examination of Joseph Smith's involvement in mysticism and the occult. In the preface to a revised 1998 edition of the book, Quinn astutely observed that many academics feel embarrassed for a scholar who even briefly acknowledges belief in the metaphysical. He argued, nevertheless, that authors had an intellectual and ethical responsibility to state one's own frame of reference when writing about the metaphysical, which he proceeded to do, succinctly describing his Mormon faith. And regarding that faith, he wrote, I make no apologies to secular humanists or religious polemicists. I happen to find Quinn's argument compelling. He's convinced me that those who write about religion owe it to their readers to come clean about their own theological frame of reference. So, here's mine. I don't know what God is, or what God had in mind when the universe was set in motion. In fact, I don't know if God even exists, although I confess that I sometimes find myself praying in times of great fear or despair or astonishment at a display of unexpected beauty. There are some 10,000 extant religious sects, each with its own cosmology, each with its own answer for the meaning of life and death. Most assert that the other 9,999 not only have it completely wrong, but are instruments of evil besides. None of the 10,000 has yet persuaded me to make the requisite leap of faith. In the absence of conviction, I've come to terms with the fact that uncertainty is an inescapable corollary of life. An abundance of mystery is simply part of the bargain, which doesn't strike me as something to lament. Accepting the essential inscrutability of existence, in any case, is surely preferable to its opposite, capitulating to the tyranny of intransigent belief. And if I remain in the dark about our purpose here, and the meaning of eternity, I have nevertheless arrived at an understanding of a few more modest truths. Most of us fear death. Most of us yearn to comprehend how we got here, and why. Which is to say, most of us ache to know the love of our Creator. And we will no doubt feel that ache, most of us, for as long as we happen to be alive. John Krakauer, January 2003. This concludes the reading of Under the Banner of Heaven, A Story of Violent Faith by John Krakauer. Copyright 2003 by John Krakauer. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Scott Brick.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.